Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
The Ulster County Legislature voted this week to codify a 2019 executive order by Democratic Congressman Pat Ryan into permanent policy. The order calls for limiting county collaboration with ICE. As the Legislative Gazette's Elias Guerra reports, the move in Ulster County is part of broader action in the Hudson Valley against immigration and customs enforcement activity.
The Ulster County policy requires federal immigration authorities to present a judicial warrant to access non-public county property and individuals, limits county employees from sharing non-public information with immigration enforcement agents unless required by law, and it prevents immigration enforcement from using county property as staging areas. Peter Criswell, the Ulster County legislator representing Kingston, said it was important to get buy-in from different branches of government.
I was very, very careful about vetting this extensively through the county executive and the county attorney, and then also through the sheriff. And so I did not move forward with putting this resolution in until I got their buy-in.
Criswell said getting everyone on the same page strengthened the resolution. In the face of ramped up immigration and customs enforcement activity during the second Trump administration, many Hudson Valley communities have been on the same page as Ulster County, exploring local measures to counteract the current immigration crackdown. To the south, Westchester has had a similar law to the one Ulster County just codified, on the books since 2018. It's called the Immigration Protection Act, and Rockland could soon pass something similar. Meanwhile, on May 19th, Ulster County will hold a public hearing about a law mandating most law enforcement to be identifiable, including ICE. Ulster County Sheriff Juan Figueroa, a Democrat, said, quote, "Anonymity undermines oversight and transparency and is unnecessary in routine operations," end quote. Democratic County Executive Jen Metzger said Americans have the constitutional right to petition the government if they feel they've been wronged.
You lose that if you don't know who it is that's violating your rights, you know, or breaking the law.
The Ulster County Legislature voted publicly in February to support immigration protection policies like the MELT Act, New York for All Act, Dignity Not Detention Act, and Access to Representation Act. And this Monday, Dutchess County voted to publicly support the MELT Act, which would ban ICE from wearing masks and plain clothes during civilian immigration actions in New York. Dutchess County Chair Yvette Valdez-Smith said ICE is out of control.
This is wholly un-American.
But not all places in the Hudson Valley agree. For instance, Putnam County Executive Kevin Byrne, a Republican, said in 2025 that Putnam is not, quote, a sanctuary county, end quote, for illegal immigrants.
We have consistently worked with our partners in law enforcement and encouraged the continued collaboration and sharing of information with all federal, state, and local law enforcement.
WAMC reported in January that a board member in the Mayapack Central School District in Putnam County, who also works for ICE, was videoed detaining someone outside of the Brewster Police Station. The Mayapack Board of Education voted to support him. At the state level, Governor Kathy Hochul has proposed a law that would eliminate agreements that allow state and local police to act on behalf of federal immigration agents. I'm Elias Guerra.
Thank you.
listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week I sat down with Times Union reporter and Capital Confidential author Dan Clark to talk about some of the major legislation holding up the state budget. We begin with auto insurance.
Oh my gosh, this is the major sticking point in budget negotiations, and it's one of these rare instances at the state capitol where you have both sides that are extremely well-funded. On one side, you have the car insurance companies, which stand to benefit from this proposal. The governor's thinking is that if they benefit, they're going to pass on those savings to the policyholders. There's nothing in her proposal that would require that, though. So these companies could just pocket the cash.
Well, why would they do that? They would want to help their customers in the state of New York, right?
I wish, believe me, if you could see my car insurance bill.
Me too.
There is an excess profits law that prevents them from making too much over a six-year period, though. The governor is saying maybe we should look at lowering that cap a little bit, but again, that proposal's not on the table. That's another, maybe we could do this, maybe we should do this. It's not something that's actually being discussed.
And when you say something like that, that opens the coffers for the lobbyists to drop their money into your campaign.
Exactly. And that's where we get to the trial lawyers, which is the other side of the equation. They're the people that you see those billboards when you're going down 787 right. and 90 that say, hey, if you're injured, give us a call. They don't specify what kind of injury because under New York State's laws, they're interpreted so liberally that really in a lot of these occasions, anybody can get a payout for almost any reason. There isn't a high bar there. So the governor's trying to tighten them a little bit, the view of lawmakers in the legislature. That being said, they say some crash victims would really stand to be negatively impacted by this. There's one proposal that would prevent damages from somebody who is found to be more at fault for a crash. Even if both parties are at fault, maybe, I don't know, somebody turned right on red when they weren't supposed to and the other person's texting and driving. Whoever is found to be more at fault in that situation, they're the ones that won't get any damages, even though the other person was also doing something illegal.
Still in negotiation. Nothing been decided on that yet, right?
Not even a little bit close to a deal on that one.
Okay, here's one the governor's been talking about for a while. Protests, buffer zones around houses of worship. That one I can see passing.
That one I can, too. The problem with that one is disagreement over the distance. The governor wants to put it 25 feet from houses of worship. Now, why 25 feet? Because we've seen historically some other buffer zones created around different locations, like reproductive health care facilities. A buffer zone of 35 feet was struck down in court in one of these cases. And that's why lawmakers are pushing for the 25 feet. They think if they go further, then it'll get struck down in court because we know civil rights groups are planning to initiate some sort of lawsuit if this passes. And it is likely that it will. Some lawmakers will say 100 feet. That is almost definitely not going to survive in court if it goes up against a challenge just based on past legal precedent. That being said, it all depends on how it's written. Anytime you bring something to court, you can tweak the language a little bit to maybe make it survive a lawsuit like that.
Yeah, and a word could be a huge difference.
Exactly. In law, the word shall versus must can be a big deal.
That's Times Union Capital Confidential author Dan Clark. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. According to a 2024 Department of Justice report, the rate of human trafficking cases referred to U.S. attorneys rose by 26% from 2012 to 2022, and rates of human trafficking around the globe continue to rise. This is where truckers may be able to help. The Legislative Gazette's Aaron Shella Levine spoke with the Truckers Against Trafficking Director of Industry, Heather Fry, at New York's Safe Trucking Symposium, held in Saratoga Springs this week.
TAT is an anti-human trafficking nonprofit, and our mission is to educate, equip, empower, and mobilize members of key industries and agencies to combat human trafficking. And so I'm here at this Trucking Association of New York's safety symposium, spreading awareness with other companies, with trucking companies, about ways that they can get involved in the fight against human trafficking. So we offer free resources, in particular our training, and we are building up a mobile army of eyes and ears out on the roads who are able to spot signs of human trafficking and know what to do if they're seeing something. So we've trained over 2.5 million individuals, and we are looking to see that number grow. If you think about truck drivers, there are over 3.5 million of them out on the roads. Law enforcement cannot be everywhere at once, and they need the people out on the streets looking to see if there's anything suspicious happening. And so that's what we're on a mission to do. And human trafficking is happening in places that they go on a regular basis. So truck stops, rest areas, hotels and motels along city streets. And so they're perfectly positioned to be able to see something and then make a simple phone call if there's something suspicious. So we're not training them to be any sort of vigilante and get involved. We discourage that, but we do want them just to pick up the phone, call law enforcement, and say, hey, I think I'm seeing something suspicious here.
Talk with me a little bit about the actual training that you do. You know, if they are the eyes and the ears, what are they hearing for? What are they listening for, rather? And what are they looking out for? You know, what are some of those telltale signs?
Yeah, some of the signs to look for. Any minor who is involved in commercial sex is automatically, by federal definition, a victim of human trafficking. There is no such thing as a child prostitute. So that would be a dead giveaway, and a call should be made right away. Other signs to look for would be any sign of control. You may witness a car with a lot of girls and a male driver dropping them off at a truck stop. You may be able to witness a trafficker who's involved in the bartering process when a girl is being sold. You may be able to see signs of abuse as well. So does the girl look disheveled? Does she have bruises? Does she look malnourished? Is she able to speak for herself, or is she under control of somebody else? Does she make eye contact with you? Does she have control of her own money and her own identification? When's the last time she saw her family? Any signs of branding, like a tattoo that could be on her neck or on her hand, a barcode, a dollar sign, a person's name indicating that she's somebody else's property or that she's for sale. So those are some of the things to look for. And our training, it's a really easy lift. It is a documentary-style training that offers a perspective of a survivor. It can be completed in less than 30 minutes, and it's free. And we offer it in a variety of methods so that companies don't have to recreate their training practice. So we make it as easy and accessible as possible.
We know that on a national level, violent crimes are on their way down. That's been a trend for a number of years at this point. What do we know about trends in sex trafficking? It seems to be one of those things that is much more in the zeitgeist these days.
Yeah. So I would say that the crime has gone underground a little bit with this digital age and so many online platforms. And the International Labor Organization actually recently, within the past, I don't know, year or two, raised one of their statistics. So we used to always say that it was $150 billion per year industry worldwide. They now have upped that to $236 billion. So while we are training and we do believe, actually we know the human trafficking hotline has let us know that more calls from truck drivers have come in since we started doing this training back in 2009. But we also know that this digital age has made it really easy for traffickers to gain access to children and young adults. And so statistics are hard to track because it does happen underneath the radar. And but we just know, we've seen enough to know that truck drivers are making phone calls, victims are being recovered, and traffickers are being arrested.
On the legislative side, whether that's local, on the state level, on the federal level, what would you guys like to see be done?
I think at a legislative level, we would love to see CDL schools implement our training. And we do have states who are doing that and working on doing that. So that's a very easy lift. And, you know, we provide everything for free. And so, yeah, I think that would be a great next step for all of the states to get on board with.
That's the Legislative Gazette's Aaron Shello Levine speaking with Truckers Against Trafficking's Heather Fry. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. A new report recommends strict parking limits at popular Adirondack trailheads. It's part of New York State's efforts to tackle overcrowding on certain hikes and summits. The public has from now until June to weigh in on those recommendations. The New York Public News Network's Emily Russell reports.
So I'm standing here at the trailhead for Cascade Mountain, which is one of the 46 high peaks in the Adirondacks. And you can hear it's right along a busy road, Route 73. And Cascade Mountain is one of the busiest trailheads in the park. On one day in August of 2023, there were 93 cars lining this busy roadway. It's dangerous, with hikers and young kids crossing the road. That same month, there was overflow parking at Cascade on every single day except one. Jackie Bowen from the Adirondack Council spent many summer weekends for years counting cars and collecting hiker data at the Cascade Trailhead.
And I could see the need. I could see people parking in poorly chosen locations, creating safety concerns for folks. And so this is an issue that's been on the forefront of my plate here at the council for a long time.
Other green groups and local leaders have also called attention to the issue over the years. They've highlighted not only parking shortages and unsafe road conditions, but also the impacts of crowded summits and eroding trails. So in 2019, the DEC formed the High Peaks Advisory Group. The following year, the group released its list of recommendations. One thing it called for was a visitor use management plan. It's a kind of framework used by land managers like the National Park Service. These plans try to strike a balance between enhancing visitor experiences and protecting the natural environment. Earlier this month, the DEC released its High Peaks Visitor Use Management Plan. Bowen from the council says it's an important first step towards sustainable management of the park's most popular areas.
We really are a world-class recreation destination. We need modernized, world-class management tools to help us protect this place, especially as we start to see rollbacks at the federal level. This is an opportunity to really protect what we have here in the Adirondacks.
Some key questions posed by the High Peaks plan are about desired conditions. Like, how many people can you run into on a trail before it feels crowded? How many people is it okay to see on a summit before it feels crowded? Researchers collected data on the summits of Cascade and Mount Marcy in 2023. They used infrared trail counters and automated traffic counters. During weekends that summer, they found that an average of 445 people per day hiked from the Adirondack Lodge, which leads to key summits like Mount Marcy.
It's just crazy, the number of people, you know, hiking Mount Marcy and Algonquin is just absurd.
Rick Preston is the supervisor of the town of North Elba, which includes Lake Placid.
There needs to be a line drawn somewhere.
From all the data and surveys collected, the report found that hikers didn't feel overcrowded if they had fewer than about 7 encounters on the trail 90% of the time. A view from a summit didn't feel crowded if there were fewer than 10 people 90% of the time. One way to achieve those desired conditions, according to the report, is by limiting parking. At the Adirondack Lodge, the report recommends banning all overflow parking. The lodge has 180 parking spots, but at times up to 100 additional cars park along the road. To manage a parking ban, the report recommends that the DEC and the town of North Elba deploy staff along the road. But Supervisor Preston says that's just not possible for the town.
From a resource standpoint, no, we do not have the resources to fund. I think they're calling for up to 4 individuals along Adirondack Lodge Road.
Courtney Koenig-Worrell is the executive director of the Adirondack Mountain Club, which owns and operates the Adirondack Lodge. She says the lodge can actually handle the amount of visitors it gets, even during peak summer weekends.
We don't find that there's an issue with crowding at our facility. And so our desire and motivation to really work on that type of enforcement, I think, is probably the lowest on the list right now of things that we want to work on.
Rather than emphasizing parking enforcement, Koenig Worrell wants to see more resources go towards educating hikers and ensuring equitable access to the high peaks.
We could be doing a lot of education in the first 5-10 minutes after they get out of their car and just let them know some of the basics, and that could go really far.
Koenig Worrell says ADK is still digging into the details of the High Peaks plan, which is about 100 pages long. But one management strategy that ADK considers a tool of last resort is permits. A permit system has been in place for years at another popular High Peaks trailhead known as the Adirondack Mountain Reserve. In fact, everyone interviewed for the story described permits as a last option, including Kathy Pedler. She's the director of advocacy for ADK.
One of the issues with permits and limiting access in that way, you have to be really careful. You're not just pushing people to other places that maybe aren't as prepared to receive a higher number of visitors.
There are other changes in the works to help ease the strain on some of the high peaks. For example, the DEC is working to reroute the trail up Cascade Mountain. The hike would start from the Mount Van Hovenberg Olympic Sports Complex, which has a big visitor center and lots of parking. That effort has been at least 8 years in the making, and it's unclear when the new trail will open. The DEC is accepting public comment on the High Peaks VUM until June 1st. It's also hosting a virtual public meeting on the report's recommendations next Wednesday, April 22nd at 6 p.m. In Lake Placid, I'm Emily Russell for the New York Public News Network.
Tom Clark, the Consul General of Canada in New York, is responsible for promoting Canadian interests in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Delaware, and Bermuda. Clark was on the SUNY Plattsburgh campus this week for the annual Distinguished Canadian Address. After delivering a speech called What's Next for Canada and the United States, Reimagining the Bilateral Relationship for a New World Order, Clark explained to the Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley what Canada's vision is for a new world order.
It's being built as we talk. The whole world is going through a rupture. The whole world is seeing a realignment of security and trading arrangements and so on. And what that's going to look like in the end is anybody's guess. But what we know is that it's moving. So Canada's position is, as Mark Carney has said, if you're not at the table, you are on the menu. And we don't want to be on the menu. And so for middle powers like Canada, and that includes a lot of Europe and it includes a lot of Asia Pacific, we've all got to figure out where we fit in this new emerging world order, whatever it happens to be. And the way we see it is that there are the hegemons, which is the United States, China, India, the big economies of the world, and then there's everybody else. If you're everybody else, you got to figure out how you're going to navigate this. And so one of the ways that you navigate this is that you get together and you say, not to challenge the hegemons, but to make sure you're not run over.
Can you talk about how worried these border communities should be about trade, the diversions of trade from Canada to other countries, and how it might impact those of us near the border?
I wouldn't worry. I'd be realistic about what's happening right now, but I'd also be realistic about what's going to happen down the road. What we've got to do, though, right now is prepare for what's next. And if you're looking at the border communities in upstate New York, in the North Country, and so on, what we collectively, and that includes Canada, what we've got to do collectively is figure out, okay, when things work themselves out and when they get to this new order that we're talking about, what's that going to look like? Because it's going to look better than what we've got right now. And so let's prepare for it.
How do you prepare for what's next when you don't know what's next?
I think that what you do is that you build on the human relationship that exists between Canadians and Americans, and particularly between upstate New York and Quebec and Ontario. We've been friends for 250 years, good friends and neighbors, and it's been the most wonderful relationship of any two countries in the world. What's happened over the past year and a half has strained that tremendously. There's been a psychic blow to Canada that will be remembered for a very long time. This does not mean, however, that Canadians are forever not going to come to the United States. Quite the contrary. I think that when they decide to come back, they'll come back in droves. But in the back of their minds, there will always be this thing, why did that happen?
Do you think the healing will accelerate once President Trump is out of office?
I think so. It's hard to project into the future, and it's hard to project into what American politics is going to look like in the years ahead. What I've discovered in this process, though, is that there is so much goodwill in the United States towards this relationship that it would seem to me almost impossible that things could go any worse than they are right now.
Do you expect any large changes, significant changes to the USMCA?
We're cautiously optimistic about USMCA, mainly because we haven't heard any voice of any consequence saying we should get rid of it. It would be very, very difficult to get rid of it even if you wanted to. But our optimism stems from the fact that that deal, that USMCA deal, has increased trade between Canada and the United States more than 25% since it was signed 5 years ago. We're in negotiations with the White House, with the trade team at the USTR. And yes, there are things to be discussed, mutual things. We both want to discuss AI, and there are a few other things. But I think that the basic foundations of USMCA are strong. Nobody is questioning the foundations.
Consul General Tom Clark says the relationship between Canada and New York's North Country is vital because the region understands the cross-border relationship better than any other region.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. Look for program number 2616. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.